Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very pleased today because we get to talk about a really interesting concept, piece of technology, thing, well, and also a book. The book is titled Air Conditioning, published by Bloomsbury in 2024 as part of their Very Cool Object Lesson series. And as any of the books in the series do, as all of them do, it takes something we think we know, we probably do know, and pokes at it in some really interesting ways. So I'm very pleased to have the author of this book, Dr. Sean Hsu, with us on the podcast to tell us all about air conditioning and how we might think about it. Sean, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Miranda. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so it's a pleasure to be here.
How wonderful. Well, we are big fans of Object Lessons, and it's always exciting to get to talk to someone in that series. So could you please start us off by introducing yourself a little bit and explain why you decided to write this book?
Sure. So I'm a professor of English at the University of California, Davis, which is located on the unceded traditional land of the Patwin people. I grew up in Southern California, where we didn't really need air conditioning except on, you know, very exceptional occasions. But we, my siblings and I, and a lot of my friends certainly felt like we needed air conditioning, right? And there are a lot of arguments with our parents over the thermostat, which I discussed briefly in the book. My graduate training and a lot of my teaching and research has been in American literature, critical race studies, and the environmental humanities. And a few years ago, I got really interested in thinking about the air as a cultural and environmental medium. The air seemed interesting to me because it's all around us and it affects all living creatures in powerful ways, but it's invisible and it's really challenging to represent. So I spent some time writing a book about the sense of smell, which came out in 2020, where I focused on how writers and artists use smell and scent to communicate experiences of environmental toxicity and to represent differentiated air. One of the ideas that inspired the book was the philosopher Peter Sloterdijk's specific approach to thinking about air conditioning. So for him, it's a concept that names a two-sided process where we condition the air that conditions humans, and also non-humans, I would add. After finishing the smell book, writing this book about air conditioning seemed like a great way to continue thinking about some of these problems. It's literally a technology that creates the conditions of everyday life, both for people on the inside and for those on the outside who have to live with the effects of air conditioning's energy consumption and waste heat. Air conditioning also calls attention to one of our senses that hasn't gotten a lot of attention in the humanities, and that's thermoception, or the sense of temperature. So I thought this book would give me a chance to keep thinking about how we sense the air as something that's a product of human activity and something that conditions people's lives in ways that have been deeply unstable and unjust. And because air conditioning is a relatively common object, it's even well known to many people who don't have access to it, it seemed like a helpful topic for a book designed to address a broader audience than academic publications, which is what the Object Lessons book series tries to do. So it's a series that I really admire, edited by Chris Schaberg and Ian Bogos, that tries to publish work that's informed by academic research and concepts, but is accessible to pretty much anyone who's curious about the topic.
So given the particular sort of way that the series is framed and the research that you've been doing that kind of brought you into it, how did you sort of think about the kind of key question the book would ask? And I suppose, well, could you tell us what that is? And then maybe also how you developed it?
Yeah, so the book's main question has to do with how air conditioning has come to quietly shape the world we live in. The individual chapters break this question down into chunks that hopefully can be read in one sitting. So I start with the history of the idea of thermal comfort and how it got marketed as a supposedly ideal condition for health, work, productivity, and even a happy marriage and family. And since families were thought of as the building blocks of the nation, thermal comfort was seen as important to the future of the nation. Then I introduced the concept of the bubble, which I also borrow from Sloterdijk, as an air-conditioned space supposedly sealed off from the air around it, and I look at some of the architectural bubbles that air conditioning has shaped. So, for example, shopping malls, movie theaters, suburban homes, and office buildings. Another chapter looks at something we generally don't think about that much, the essential role that air conditioning plays in preserving cultural artifacts in museums and archives, and in storing and circulating online data. I also consider air conditioning's effects on the world outside the bubble. So especially its impacts on climate change, its connections with racism, and the perspectives of people in hotspots in the US and throughout the global South who don't have access to, or don't have much access to air conditioning.
That is quite a range. Thank you for taking us through that. I suppose in some ways I'm going to kind of go through them in the order you mentioned them, but we'll see. I mean, there's so many things there to ask about. Starting with that kind of big question at the beginning of the quietly shaping lives, of the sort of without us noticing part of this, can you help us understand air conditioning in this context of air more broadly? How does air conditioning perpetuate, quote, the problem of not being able to think about air in historical and material terms?
So one of my arguments in the book is that air conditioning makes us desensitized to the air, both inside air-conditioned spaces and to the air that's outside them, right? At least for those who are on the inside. For the economically privileged, it offers comfortable, filtered air that you don't have to think about. In other words, it's a buffer that protects the most privileged from the air pollution and climate impacts of their own consumption. But I want to stress that it's not air conditioning itself that makes it hard to think about air. It's how we use it and how we relate to it. For example, thermostats make air conditioning work on autopilot so that we're completely sealed off from natural temperature fluctuations. And people often think about air conditioning as cooling the air when what it actually does is move hot air somewhere else to somewhere outside. This warms the air outside of air-conditioned spaces, and one of my main arguments is that we have to think hard about that. That's why I asked for the window unit pictured on the book cover to be a warm reddish color. It was originally a blue color that the designer had proposed. So I wanted to draw attention to the air conditioner as a two-sided technology that gives off significant quantities of waste heat and greenhouse gases at the same time that it maintains indoor environments and ways of thinking that are sealed off from outdoor conditions. So weather making is a term that's often used to brand air conditioners, right? That they make the indoor weather. But I thought it was really important for obvious reasons, right? To flip that and think about weather making as something that air conditioning is really doing outdoors as well. So I think that as long as we only think of air conditioning as an indoor technology, it distances us from its historical effects. For example, the accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and the uneven accumulation of air pollution and toxins in people's bodies.
Lots there that kind of, as you said, quietly, unobtrusively is happening, which makes it sort of all the more important to think about what is going on and also how we got here. Because as you point out in the book, it's really interesting to think about temperature in terms of comfort, or comfort being defined as a very specific numerical temperature range. How did we get to this point?
So for the part of the book that really thinks about the history of research on thermal comfort, I draw on some of the great historical work that's been done by scholars like Marsha Ackerman, Eric Dean Wilson, and Nicole Staroselsky. So I just want to pause to acknowledge and recommend their great books on air conditioning and temperature. I don't know if they've all had podcast episodes, but they should. So air conditioning was first introduced to stabilize materials and standardize production, whether for color printing, fabric, or in the food industry. From there, air conditioning marketers promoted other uses for it. So they claimed that it would make factory workers happier and more productive, and that it would attract customers to department stores and movie theaters in the summertime and help keep them satisfied. So starting in the 1920s, scientists started designing studies to show how air conditioning affects productivity. Although most of these studies focused on the thermal preferences of white middle-class men, the primary test subjects, they set the tone for thinking about thermal comfort as something that optimizes human capacities and also corporate profits. recommended temperature settings vary across time and place. So ASHRAE standard has been around 67 to 82 degrees Fahrenheit. And ASHRAE is an acronym for, I think, the American Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers. But the amount of research and public attention that these temperature settings get shows how committed a lot of people are to the idea that there's a uniform and universal temperature range that people should inhabit, right? Even though that range has shifted over time, so comfort zones have become cooler. And also, even though it's well known that men tend to prefer, on the average, a lower thermostat setting than women. The thermostat made it possible to have a kind of set it and forget it relationship with indoor temperature. Its promise is to make indoor thermal comfort something you'll never have to think about again. One important point that scholars have made about the huge amount of attention and resources focused on thermostatic comfort is that it draws attention away from all the other factors that affect our sense of temperature, like physical activity or metabolism, humidity, food, clothing, sunlight, and so forth. This pulls the focus away from other, more potentially sustainable ways we could intervene to change our thermal experience. And it leaves us with a very narrow idea of what temperature even, or what thermoception even is.
Which makes it so interesting then to think about the idea of kind of how much is happening that we don't notice given these tensions. Like, why aren't we noticing them? I think a lot of that, as you demonstrate in the book, has to do with kind of how embedded air conditioning is in not just big picture things, but in like everyday experiences all over the place. In the many examples you included in the book, and of course kind of researched and thought about much more beyond that, what do you think are some of the most profound ways that air conditioning has impacted or even transformed those kind of everyday, quote, normal things that we do?
So there are so many of these, it's really hard to kind of like keep them all in mind or to rank them, but some things I learned about that surprised me when researching the book were how air conditioning has been displacing a whole spectrum of other more sustainable techniques for coping with heat. So these range from social customs like taking siestas and sitting on the porch or even going out for ice cream collectively in the summertime, to architectural features like porches themselves or windows that open, or buildings oriented to maximize shade and cross breezes, or using thermally efficient building materials like adobe. So every summer now, we get these articles in the news or on blogs that kind of give you advice on how to like open your windows or move to rooms that are more shady, kind of like, you know, the titles are often how to keep cool without air conditioning. And it's just striking because this used to be really common knowledge not so long ago, right? But we've largely forgotten it, or it's become eroded. And so we need to be reminded of it again and again. By deliberately designing homes, office buildings, and other structures in ways that can't be effectively cooled without machines. So for example, windows that don't open, or homes that don't have much access to trees, like a tree canopy or other kinds of shade, we've become architecturally dependent on air conditioning. Sealing people off into different air-conditioned bubbles also has the effect of separating people from the outside world and from the public. So, for example, think of how the privately owned pseudo-public space of the shopping mall has replaced public squares as a gathering place, or how indoor cooling has reduced people's involvement with what's going on outside the home, or what Jane Jacobs called eyes on the street. Which is something that Jacobs saw as really important to public safety and other community benefits. And let me just end by saying something about something that I wish that I had included in the book but didn't get to, and that's the really important role of air conditioning in laboratory science, right? So it's really important to have, you know, climate control as a control for these experiments, but then there's a kind of continuity where the conditions of the lab, scholars have shown, the conditions of the lab then kind of mimic these ideal conditions in the world that don't exist without air conditioning either, right? So there's a kind of like self-fulfilling circularity there. I mean, another kind of sort of data-driven model of this would be that we use standardized tests, right, to measure the effects of standardized air conditioning on children's learning. but that's really measuring a very specific form of thinking.
Yeah, no, and a form of thinking that is shaped and shapes so many aspects of kind of social relations. It goes beyond just sort of what experiment could be done in the lab or what does that particular test say in that room. I want to ask perhaps about maybe one of the most extreme examples of sort of shaping social and economic relations discussed in the book, which is the role of air conditioning in intensifying and normalizing racial inequality in the U.S. Can you talk us through this part of the research?
Sure. So air conditioning was introduced into a situation where there were already long historical connections between temperature and racism. And I talk about some of those in the book. So one key example of these is climatic racism, ideas about biological racial differences being the result of hot climates, or on the flip side, temperate European climates being supposedly optimal for growing sturdy and, you know, supposedly rational people. There are some really offensive ads from the 1950s that illustrate this kind of climatic racism. And I talk about one of them in the book, but was threatened by a lawyer from a certain AC corporation when I inquired about reproducing it. And then the image of it available online also mysteriously disappeared. Or we can also think about how segregation denied Black people access to the means of cooling. So, for example, cold drinking fountains, swimming pools, beaches, and air-conditioned movie theaters and train cars. Air conditioning's emissions, including the heat it moves outside of buildings onto the streets, add to the urban heat island effect, which is a term for a phenomenon that makes some urban areas up to 10 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than the surrounding non-urban region. There have been some recent widely reported studies showing significant correlations between urban heat island effects and historically redlined neighborhoods. And redlining is a practice in the U.S. where banks marked off disproportionately Black and brown neighborhoods as supposedly high risk and denied them access to home loans. And of course, the socioeconomic effects of redlining also reduce access and, you know, the ability to afford air conditioning in a lot of Black and brown urban neighborhoods. I also look at the absence of adequate air conditioning in prisons, especially in the Sun Belt states, which has led to documented instances of heat exhaustion and heat-related death, and at the use of air conditioning to torture detainees at Guantanamo Bay, and to torture migrants detained at the U.S.-Mexico border. Across all these very different examples, there's an overarching pattern of using uncomfortable, debilitating, and even fatal temperatures to produce racial difference. And so this kind of like study of temperatures relations with power, colonialism, and race, it's a kind of growing research area. Nicole Starosielski has coined the term critical temperature studies to kind of describe this field. And it's one that I find really exciting.
Thank you for giving us that sort of peek into that area. It is really interesting to think about how these things go together in ways that we might not necessarily think that they do, but that's the power of this kind of angle and this sort of book. I want to ask about another aspect of the book as well, because it's not, I mean, yes, that's one chapter of it and that's an important chapter of it, but quite helpfully, I think you don't just do that. The book does so many things despite being quite small. Can you talk about a different aspect of the book where you talk about air conditioning being present, having sort of social impacts on us, but less about kind of the physical reality of different neighborhoods or borders? And in this aspect about film and literature, when we see representations of air conditioning or absences of air conditioning, can you talk us through what's sort of interesting and significant to you in this area?
Yeah, thanks. So this is a question that I was really interested in and, you know, part of what motivated me to write the book, because I teach literature, film, art, culture, for a living, right? And one of the questions in my mind is, how do you teach students about air conditioning in representational works, right? So one of the obvious places that air conditioning is present, and I think it's one that we don't think enough about, is in a lot of the places where we store and consume movies and books and other media. It's used to preserve all sorts of media in archives. It's a more or less expected amenity in American movie theaters. And a lot of reading happens in climate-controlled spaces. I also often, when I'm talking with students about air conditioning, I ask them to kind of think about and just attune themselves to the air in the classroom, right? And you can even hear often the kind of hum of the air conditioning in the background. And this assumption that air conditioning is a condition of detached rational thought is really built into the spaces, well, at least the spaces where more privileged college students in the world learn in and talk about stuff in. So in the book, I also spend some time looking closely at films where air conditioning is noticeably absent. So in Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, for example, we learn right away that the pizzeria's air conditioner is broken. And most of the film happens on the street on the hottest day of the year. In a recent Angolan film by Fradique, the title is Ar Condicionado, or Air Conditioner, window air conditioning units are mysteriously falling off of high-rises in the city of Luanda and killing people on the streets below. Both these movies are about communities and places made even hotter by air conditioning, where inequality leaves people suffering in the heat. Do the Right Thing is a great example of a film that makes audiences sit with the intense temperature of the urban heat island. There's famously a lot of warm, reddish colors in the film. But it also shows us how people find ways to cool down and flourish in the heat. So here I'm thinking of one of the film's most memorable scenes. A lot of listeners will probably remember it. Still from it is reproduced in the book. And that's the scene where the neighborhood spontaneously repurposes a fire hydrant as a different kind of infrastructure for pleasure and community cooling. In literature, one of the most striking examples I look at in the book is from the novelist Mohsin Hamid's work, his novel Mock Smoke, which is set in the globalizing city of Lahore, Pakistan. Partway through that novel, Hamid includes a whole chapter that puts the plot on pause and goes back and just interprets all the characters and actions in the novel in terms of their relative access to air conditioning. And it's actually framed as a kind of like legal reflection, right? So in the context of a court case and a legal presentation. The chapter pushes readers to think again about everything that's been happening through the lens of thermal inequality. It trains readers to see the vastly uneven availability of air conditioning in the city and across different parts of the world as an active force that has all kinds of effects on characters' psychology, relationships, and life chances, and then also frames all of this as something that the law is unable to kind of fully take into account.
I think there's probably a bunch of people right now Googling those and going, oh, wait, I want to watch that. Oh, wait, hang on. I want to engage with that.
I hope
so. Yeah, no. So thank you for taking us through some examples of kind of ways that air conditioning or its lack is turning up in some forms of art. I'd like to ask you about another aspect of art as we move forward, but I suppose a more kind of physical side of it, I guess. Can you tell us about museums and cultural institutions, and how might we kind of completely reframe our thinking if we take into account the air conditioning needed to kind of keep them going?
Sure. So I draw here on the communication scholar Fernando Dominguez Rubio's work. He teaches at UC San Diego, and he has this fantastic metaphor of museums as just gigantic refrigerators, right? So he draws on his experience as an embedded researcher in the Museum of Modern Art's Conservation Department, and he explains in his book, how the air in museums and their storage facilities is carefully controlled to preserve the material stability of artworks. Right. So he calls this kind of like the atmospheric conditions of producing eternity for artworks. The air in museums isn't ultimately for the humans. It's designed to extend the lifetime of materials like paper, canvas, and oil paint. This draws attention to the vast cooling infrastructures that have to be running 24/7 to preserve cultural objects in museums and archives, especially in more technologically advanced museums in wealthy countries. I call the externalities of museum and archival cooling cultural emissions. So this is a term for the huge quantities of greenhouse gases and energy expenditure that go toward preserving prestigious collections of art and archival materials that scholars have shown to be deeply colonial and Eurocentric in their values. Scholars have criticized what they call the violence of the archive, which shapes both its exclusions and how it frames its inclusions, and how it allows access and to whom. I argue that this violence of the archive also extends to the archive's emissions, which contribute to climate change that disproportionately harms people who have been marginalized by the most well-resourced museums and archives. Climate control in museums also helped me understand why olfactory art and art that incorporates the sense of temperature are really difficult to exhibit and preserve in conventional white cube galleries. There's a lot of anxiety about contamination, so the air in the museum is designed to be unnoticed, something that allows for the fantasy of a purely visual, disembodied encounter with the art. So the idea that the viewer is separate from the art object they're viewing is built into the museum space through its climate control. The exceptions to this pattern, and I talk about some of them in the book, they're really interesting. So one example is the air conditioning show planned by Art and Design in the 1960s, which would simply present an air conditioner in an empty room with some printed material kind of posted on the wall, explaining that the air of the gallery and its carefully conditioned thermal equilibrium are themselves the artwork that's on display, and that should be the subject of the visitor's contemplation.
Huh. Really interesting to think about that, especially anyone who kind of next walks into a space like that and sort of looks around, maybe at the art, but also maybe also at sort of the vents and thinks about the temperature and thinks about kind of what's happening there. So thank you for that sort of perspective on museums and cultural centers. I want to sort of, some of the examples we've spoken about so far have been specifically US, right? Especially if we're talking about racial inequality and the particular ways it's been enacted in the United States. But things like museums and cultural centers, that's not just in the United States. They're in many places around the world. To what extent have other countries approached or implemented air conditioning in the same way that the US has? Do we see variation across countries? Is the US representative or quite different?
Yeah, so different countries have had really different ways of implementing air conditioning. So there is quite a bit of variation. Dominguez Rubio talks, for example, about how the kind of state-of-the-art technologies for preservation in Global North art museums basically leaves artists in poorer countries in this kind of double bind, right? So they're really incentivized to sell their work to, you know, museums that are far away in the Global North, because that's where those works are going to be best preserved, because their own country's museums don't necessarily have the resources to keep artworks stable, you know, at such a standard. I should also just kind of say first off that this is the question of kind of air conditioning's adaptation or adoption globally is the part of the book that I felt the least qualified to kind of think about, right? Because I'm an Americanist, trained really in American literature and American studies. But it's also something that it was really exciting for me to learn about. And it's just kind of, there are all these rabbit holes that I could have gone down much deeper. So some of the countries that have taken up air conditioning at rates similar to the US include oil-rich nations like Dubai, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. And wealthy Asian countries like Japan and Singapore. So the founding prime minister of Singapore famously called air conditioning the most important invention of the 20th century. And he credited it with enabling the country's rapid development and modernization. But there are also important differences. So Asian households, for example, typically use smaller single room air conditioners that can be much more efficient than central air, which is more common in the US. There's also been a lot of attention to so-called developing countries where air conditioning use has been spreading quickly in connection with both climate change and economic growth. So for example, China has more air conditioning units than the US now, and 40% of Chinese households still don't have air conditioning. So there's a lot more room for growth there. There's also a lot of projected growth in air conditioning use in India and throughout Southeast Asia. And I should just say that, you know, there's like really problematic patterns of reporting around this kind of developing country projected growth in air conditioning, right? That is what's going to cause climate change to go past the tipping point, or that it's being adopted in irresponsible ways and you kind of overused in, you know, different places in the developing world. But I think that all kind of draws responsibility and attention away from the US's really just gigantic and essential role, not only in kind of consuming energy through its normalization of air conditioning, but producing a culture and just, you know, forms of architecture and all of these things that really spread the use of air conditioning to other countries as well. So especially in hot regions where heat-related deaths have been on the rise, it's important to be focusing on questions of equity and framing access to air conditioning as a public health issue rather than just one of kind of cutting down on consumption, right? I mean, in some ways, those two are connected, right? But it's also important to keep in mind that there has been serious resistance to the social and cultural changes that air conditioning brings. So one example that I talk about is the Samoan author Albert Wendt, who calls Western tourist hotels air-conditioned coffins. He's drawing attention there to how air-conditioned spaces have made hot places in the global south more appealing to Western settlers and tourists. So these tourist hotels really kind of reconfigure a lot of, indigenous Pacific spaces into kind of like tourist economies, right? And he's also really interested there in how climate control deadens the senses and seals people off from the world around them.
Some interesting things to think about there, particularly in terms of kind of what other options there might be. What alternatives, I suppose? I mean, I guess extend that, right? What kinds of thinking might be possible, not just in terms of kind of the policy of what do particular countries do or not do, but if we go even further, what might be possible if we think outside of trying to maintain a goal of perfectly thermally comfortable rooms?
Yeah, so I mean, in some ways, that's a question that the book poses and explores, but doesn't fully follow through on. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that, you know, as I'm talking and as I did a lot of the work on the book, I was in thermally comfortable spaces, right? The air conditioning or heat may not have been on, but it's usually available. So, I mean, positionally, my answer to this question maybe can't be fully trusted. But in the book, I suggest that air conditioning, it anesthetizes us to temperature and to a sense of connectedness with our surroundings, right? So, for example, it detaches us from knowledges that might relate to patterns of climate, like to feeling those patterns of climate or the daily course of the sun, or knowledge available through outdoor smells. Experiencing some thermal variation and even discomfort might put us in a better position to know more intimately what it's like to be interdependent with the planet and the air and to share that air with others, humans and non-humans. But our sense of temperature is also deeply embodied. It's tied to visceral and emotional responses. While air conditioning aligns with the problematic Enlightenment idea that feelings are supposedly the opposite of thought, scholars of affect, queer studies, and critical race studies have shown that emotion and affect can be really important components of thinking, especially thinking that moves us to individual and collective action. One of my sources for thinking about correlations between temperature, emotion, and embodied knowledge is the poet Claudia Rankine's suggestion that, as she puts it, maybe anger is a kind of knowledge. So what we might call cold, detached, and fact-based knowledge of environmental injustice and climate change has clearly not been enough to prevent all sorts of ongoing awfulness. Maybe what we need is something like hot knowledge, right? So knowledge that's not sealed off from its surroundings and thinking that centers the experiences of people who have more intimate and extensive knowledge of temperature variations than those of us who spend most of our lives in air-conditioned bubbles.
Yeah.
I think that's a really kind of useful point to sort of be like, the book asks a question and then kind of answers it, but also leaves a lot open. I think that invites people in some really useful ways. What do you hope readers take away from the book?
Thanks for that generous response to my failure to follow through, by the way. But what I hope, I mean, I guess I hope that the book is going to spark readers' curiosity about how air conditioning and other infrastructures that people take for granted quietly shape our lives and shape the world we live in. And I hope the curiosity is going to stretch far beyond just the people who spend a lot of their lives in air-conditioned comfort, right? So that readers will also be curious about how cooling infrastructures affect the weather outside, both nearby and on a planetary scale, and how they affect people whose labor extracts the fuel that powers air conditioners, or how they impact the communities most exposed to climate change and air pollution. I hope the book will help readers see air conditioning differently, and that would include seeing air conditioning's effects where we wouldn't maybe have expected to find them, and also maybe even to feel it differently as the technology designed to disconnect us from the air around us and from the humans and non-humans who live in it with us. The idea isn't to do away with air conditioning or to make readers feel guilty about it. As I said, I use it too. But to raise questions about how it shapes our ways of living and thinking, who it benefits and who it harms, and how it can be distributed in more just and equitable ways.
Huh. All right, that's some very interesting things for people to take away. Lots packed into a very tiny and cute looking book. So thank you for taking us through that. As my final question, given kind of the research interests that brought you into this particular project and the kind of particular audience that books in this series have, it's a very sort of, I imagine in some ways, like a little bit of a weird project to be working on. But now that you've gotten to the end of it, has it kind of opened up new things that you want to work on? Or is there anything you're working on now that it's done, whether or not it's related to this?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I do think that there are other projects about temperature on the back burner. I wrote a more kind of like research-oriented piece on a restaging of Amiri Baraka's play Dutchman that happened in a sauna, or in a couple of saunas in Chicago and New York City, I think around 2014, right? So really like thinking through the non-representational effects of temperature in a theatrical context with like, you know, racial violence and collective affect all just sort of like bubbling up in tight spaces. So that's something that I think I'm probably going to return to in the longer run. In the short term, I'm writing some shorter pieces about smell in multimodal installations by Dane Mitchell and Candice Lin. Dane Mitchell is an artist from New Zealand, and he has an upcoming installation that will be in an old auto garage that's been converted into a gallery in Melbourne. I don't think the details of his installation have been announced yet, so I'm not going to say more about it, except that it sounds really fantastic and there will be lots of smells. Candice Lin is based at UCLA, and she makes amazing, sensuously rich installations that reimagine materials that have been central to histories of race and empire and global commerce. So, for example, lithium, opium, and indigo. And porcelain. I'm really looking forward to spending some time thinking alongside their artworks. And then I'm also getting started on a longer book that's sort of a sequel to my book on smell and atmospheric violence. So the new book on smell turns from the topic of toxicity to works of literature, art, and experimental perfuming that approach smell as a tool of repair and world making. So I'll look at some works of speculative fiction that use smell to imagine alternate and more just and livable futures. And I'll also be looking at olfactory and multimodal artworks that try to foreground the lived experience and collective memories of migrants and indigenous people. So these projects that I'll be looking at make it clear that those of us living in deodorized or commodified, and I think also air conditioned and ventilated smellscapes, have only a very limited sense of what smell is capable of. For example, these works explore scent as a medium that can communicate suppressed historical experiences, or as a capacity for interspecies chemical communication that a huge range of life forms, including plants and even fish, participate in. So that's the sum of what I've been working on.
Well, that all sounds absolutely fascinating. So thank you for giving us those little sneak peeks. And while you are investigating, thinking about all of these topics, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing titled Air Conditioning, published by Bloomsbury as part of the Object Lesson series. Sean, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.